And now we continue the weekly news review. We're going to talk about some business headlines in the Cincinnati area, and we're joined by the guys who know a lot about that from the Business Courier, reporters Tom DeMaropoulos. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon, Michael. How are you?
And Steve Watkins. We have Steve as well. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Michael. How you doing?
I'm doing well. So glad that both of you could join us because there's been a lot going on in the business world as it relates to this COVID-19 pandemic as well. Tom, I want to start with you because we've done segments on this program before where we discuss the number of hotels that are underway or were underway in our region. You did a report on this week. Talk a little bit about what you found as the tri-state hotel boom comes to a sudden stop.
Yeah, so we were taking a look at kind of, you know, obviously the hospitality industry has been decimated by the coronavirus, and that's kind of the news of the day right now. But we wanted to take a look ahead and see, well, when we kind of come out of this and when we start to see some normalcy, when people are able to travel again, what is hotel development going to look like? Because we had been seeing so many rooms and hotel projects being added, was that going to continue? So to give an idea here, there were 15 active projects either in the works or under construction in and around downtown Cincinnati that were going to add about, call it, you know, more than 1,800 rooms. That doesn't include a replacement for the Millennium Hotel, which could be another 600 to 800 hotel rooms. So as we, you know, we're looking at that, we found that the projects that are currently underway, if they're under construction, are still planning to finish up. But it's a lot of these projects that were still in the development phase that are either kind of on hold or you know, waiting to see what their future is going to be going forward, just because there's too much uncertainty, I think, is the number one thing in terms of what's the demand going to be, how many people are going to be traveling, is there going to be room to open more hotels when things return to some sense of normalcy.
And did you get any indication from developers or people in this type of world on when that picture might be a little clearer?
No, unfortunately, we're still kind of managing through the worst of it right now. And a couple of these developers said, you know, they're not making decisions right now because they don't want to decide on development projects under duress because they have existing portfolios of hotels where they're trying to manage furloughing employees and they're trying to see, you know, which hotels they should keep open and how they should go about shutting other ones down. So we're really, there's not an idea of when, and it's really dependent upon when we start to see the government easing restrictions on travel. Now, one thing that was interesting in talking to these hotel developers is that they think the consumer will, you know, kind of the leisure traveler will be back a little bit quicker because they think people will be tired of being at home and just seeing the four walls kind of around them. They'll be ready to go out and experience and travel again. But it's corporate travel, business travel, they think might be a little bit slower to come back because businesses, one, will be kind of looking to cut expenses where they can. So if a Zoom meeting works instead of sending someone across the country for an in-person meeting, they might look to do that. And then the safety aspect of it, they don't want to you know, be having their employees travel for work until they're kind of sure that it's safe to do so again.
Steve Watkins is also a reporter at the Business Courier. And Steve, you've done a lot of stories this week on the banking industry, and we've been paying close attention, of course, to the federal government's money that was infused into the economy to try to bolster employment and to keep people employed, particularly through the Paycheck Protection Program. What can you tell us about what you learned from local bank executives through this process?
Yeah, there certainly have been a lot of stories. I was going back through. I think I've written six stories in about the last week on the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP program for short, as a lot of people refer to it. The banks, it's been an interesting process. I mean, for people that don't know how that program works, in a nutshell, Congress approved money 2 weeks ago, $349 billion worth to help small businesses, which are any business 500 employees or less. So really virtually any business other than the really huge ones would qualify. And the idea is for those businesses to get money to tide them over for at least the next 2 months. It's based on 2.5 months, actually, of payroll costs. And the idea is for them to be able to keep people employed, obviously, and, you know, keep the economy from running too far aground. What ended up happening, predictably, is all these companies rushed immediately to apply, and it overwhelmed the system, both from the standpoint of the banks and from the standpoint of the Small Business Administration, the federal agency that is overseeing this. And really with the SBA, I know I was given some numbers that the amount of loans that they were trying to process within the span of about a week was multiple times the amount that they typically process in a year. And so the SBA really wasn't set up for this onslaught, and most banks weren't either. They're not used to having all these applications come through at once.
Yeah, you noted that some bank websites had a hard time.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. A lot of banks, banks staffed up. They had people working weekends and working overnight and things like that to get these through. But nonetheless, we heard from several business owners who said, hey, I've tried to get through to various banks and I couldn't. Some banks actually stopped taking new applications after a few days because they said, we just can't service the people that are coming in now. We need to get the ones that are already in through. So it really was a bit of a mess. And the big issue, well, there were two big issues for timing. One is, of course, a lot of businesses are really struggling these last several weeks. And the sooner they can get money, the better chance they have to keep their employees. The other issue is companies were concerned that the money was going to run out. That's what we had heard. And in fact, last night, it did run out. So anybody who has not had an application already approved by the SBA at this point won't get their loan funded. Now, there's an expectation that Congress will add possibly $250 billion to that, but it hasn't happened yet, so there's a bit of uncertainty.
And we're talking with Tom DeMiropoulos and Steve Watkins of the Cincinnati Business Courier. And Steve, just to stay on this subject for a moment longer, the banking community plays a significant role in Cincinnati's economy, downtown particularly, a lot of workers down there. I know that you profiled specifically Fifth Third Bank and how they plan to withstand this pandemic from a business side of things outside of PPP. What does the banking industry look like as we navigate this pandemic?
Yeah, it's interesting. You're right. There are a lot of employees in the financial services industry, many at the banks. Fifth Third is headquartered here. It's the ninth biggest bank in the country, if you go by U.S.-based banks that are largely focused on consumers and not businesses and things like that. So they're huge. They employ I think it's 22,000 people, a big chunk of that is here. There's several thousand of their employees that are local. Other U.S. Bank is real big here. PNC is, Huntington, First Financial Bank is headquartered here. We have a lot of employees. The way the banking industry looks right now is what's going to happen is, and I talked to Greg Carmichael, the CEO of Fifth Third, about this. Banks are going to get a lot of loan defaults, so a lot of their borrowers are not going to be able to pay back their loans, which makes sense. And so ultimately, they're going to have to have more money reserved for that. It's going to cut into the bank earnings. But one of the saving graces here for banks is the last time we had a big crisis was in 2008 and 2009, when we had the financial crisis, and that was really centered on the banking industry. It was a banking crisis, and there was a time where people weren't sure if our financial system was going to survive. We needed government bailouts. This time, numerous bankers have made a point of this. It's not a banking crisis. It's a healthcare crisis, and banks are certainly caught in that, but they're far more capitalized than they were back in 2008, and so they've got more money to be a cushion to be able to cover a lot of these loans that will go bad until things get back to normal. So at this point, yes, it is going to hurt banks' earnings quite significantly, and their stock prices have shown that. They've come down a lot. But the survivability of banks at this point is not really in question too much. In 2008 and 9, the survivability of a lot of banks was in question.
Tom DeMaropoulos is also with the Cincinnati Business Courier. And Tom, you noted Fidelity's scaling up of hiring. So if the industry is facing some uncertainty, what's going on at Fidelity that they want to add employees, including about 300 at the Covington campus?
Yes, so Fidelity is looking to accelerate their hiring of about 2,000 people across the country. And Michael, as you said, about 300 employees locally. They're looking to fill those positions between April and June. They're looking to hire, you know, different professionals here, financial service associates, customer relationship advocates, and licensed financial professionals. And, you know, this comes as the coronavirus has kind of, you know, just wreaked havoc on the American economy. And so they wanted to increase this hiring to make sure that Fidelity is able to provide their clients with the information and the help that they need during this challenging period. You know, so they're seeing just an unprecedented level of engagement from individual clients who are kind of looking at their stocks and their 401ks and trying to see what should they be doing. So they want to make sure that they have enough people kind of trained on board to handle this increase in people looking into this, because typically, you know, your 401k is for a lot of people, it's just you contribute to it each paycheck, and you don't think about it too much. But right now, with the economy being the way it is and the stock market being the way it is, I think a lot more people are paying attention to it and reaching out looking for advice.
But we did see some job losses in Northern Kentucky. You wrote about Groupon. Maybe people didn't know there was a facility where Groupon fulfilled some of its goods near the airport. What happened?
Yeah, so Groupon is, and I think this is part of a larger issue for the Chicago-based company, as they are looking at terminating or furloughing about 2,800 employees, the majority of which will take place during the second quarter. Now, this in Northern Kentucky, they had an operation. It was their Groupon Goods Fulfillment Center. This was located at 1081 Aviation Boulevard, and that they plan to kind of shut this facility down by beginning of June, June 7th, and this would result in about 92 employees losing their jobs. And this is, you know, Groupon's really been hurt by the coronavirus, so I think this is just another one of those moves that is meant to try to help them get through this as they try to focus on things that are going to continue to make them money, and they're going to try to streamline some operations.
But as one business shuts down near the airport, it looks like there's real estate around CVG that is apparently still valuable. So you wrote about New York-based Clarion Partners. What did it buy out there?
So it purchased about 111 acres of land near the International Airport by CVG, and this is there's two pieces of property along a Bulletsville road, and they purchased the land for a total of $14 million. That breaks down to about $126,000 per acre. Now, I wasn't able to get comment from Clarion Partners about what they plan to do with this property, but if you look at what's been happening around the airport, I've got a pretty good sense that this is probably going to be industrial development, with Amazon being there and with just this boom we've seen in logistics and shipping. I would guess that would be the likely use for this property going forward.
And Steve Watkins is also with the Business Courier and is on the line with us. Steve, I couldn't let you guys go without talking a little bit of baseball, even though a lot of people are missing it right now. We would be in the midst of the early stages of the season. You wrote about the Forbes report on the Reds' value. Forbes, of course, looked at all of Major League Baseball. Where do the Reds fall in value compared to other teams in Major League Baseball?
They fall near the bottom of the list, and that's nothing new for the Reds. A lot of it's because we're in a very small market compared to the rest of Major League Baseball. But and the increase was not that great either this past year. Their value rose 2%, which is pretty small increase compared to the rest of baseball. I think they ranked 21st in increase in value, and they rank something like 27th in total valuation. But don't worry too much about Bob Castellini and the other owners. The Reds are worth $1.075 billion, according to Forbes. Forbes does these estimates every year of every franchise, actually, in every one of the major sports. Reds, while they don't rank very high, they're nearly four times as valuable as they were in 2006 when the Castellinis bought the franchise. The Castellinis led an investment group that paid $270 million back then, which is an awful lot of money, but they've gotten a pretty nice gain so far. It's only on paper, but a nice gain in valuation. So, yeah, things... You're right. I'm a huge sports fan and really missing baseball, as I know a lot of people are, to the point that I watched an inning of the Taiwanese Baseball League on Twitter this morning because they are actually playing live baseball games. So at least there's something out there.
Yeah, what a time to kind of be alive, huh? And I know that Kansas City is often used as a benchmark when it comes to our streetcar conversations here, but a lot of people argue that Kansas City has a better public transportation situation than Cincinnati. We should note, then, that Kansas City is one of three teams that are worth less than the Cincinnati Reds, according to that Forbes document, along with the Tampa Bay Rays and Miami Marlins. Steve Watkins, Tom DeMiropoulos from the Cincinnati Business Courier, always great to have you guys on. Thank you so much for your time today. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too, Michael. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
Up next, we'll talk with Tana Weingartner from WVXU. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition.